Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer. Hello and welcome to Coffeehouse Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Balls. So late last night, the government published its withdrawal agreement bill, the WAB, over 100 pages of legal text setting out the small print to Boris's Brexit deal. Katie, were there any surprises in there?
I don't think there are any major surprises in terms of the WAB, the withdrawal agreement bill, but there's definitely, I suppose, some things that have been outlined or given more detail of, which will cause alarm on various corners or could potentially. I mean, one thing that was quickly flagged is the fact that in this transition period, European law still applies. And some say that's something the European Research Group could feel uncomfortable with. Mm. And if there are new laws during the transition period made by the EU, they would in effect come into effect in the UK. So I think that's something which will make some Brexiteers feel uneasy. But you're also getting the sense, if you look at the reactions and what Steve Baker is saying this morning, that this isn't changing the European Research Group's position on this, that they're still backing this deal. And there are some things for the European Research Group in there. So the fact, for example, that you have the idea of the scrutiny, so Bill Cash's committee would be asked to examine these things as they come in. So I think you can see how the Brexiteers have something they don't want, but there's also this acknowledgement that they will get a chance to look over it and to almost bring them in a sense. The thing on the other end, which I think is worrying those who veer more to remain, is the fact that when it comes to the end of this transition period under this deal, which is proposed to be the end of December 2020, there wouldn't be a parliamentary vote on not extending it. So there would be a parliamentary vote if you wanted to extend the transition period further, and you'd have to get Parliament to say yes to that. But there would be no vote if the government just wanted to end it.
So the government has to propose it first.
So if the government wants to end at the end of December, that would not require a Commons vote. If the government wanted to extend the transition period, that would. Now, there are some figures such as Hilary Benn who think that, if anything, it should be the other way around, because they worry, and this is what's been flagged quite quickly, Boris Johnson's Brexit deal is now almost being confirmed. What they worry about is, in the transition period, there is not enough time to negotiate a comprehensive trade agreement with the EU. So you could get to the end of December going into January 2021 and effectively go to WTO, go to a no-deal Brexit, something everyone thought they had just about managed to avoid. So I think this is laying out how there isn't a provision at the moment for Parliament to stop that. But obviously, if this gets going, we'll get into amendment territory.
I think this is nowhere near as big a deal as people on both sides of the argument think it is. What is one of the things we have undoubtedly learned from the Brexit process, which is if Parliament wishes to assert itself, it can. That the new Speaker is likely to be in the mould of John Bercow, and there is a new precedent created for backbenchers taking over the order paper and pushing stuff through. So if there is a majority in Parliament in December 2020 for extending the transition and against, presuming there is no trade deal agreed at that point, against going on to WTO terms for trade with the EU, it will force the government to extend the transition.
In the same way the Benn Act was.
Exactly, to seek an extension. I mean, this is in some ways simpler because the potential of extending the transition is in the withdrawal agreement. So I really think this is one of these issues which is nowhere near as totemic as people on either side think. In the same way, if there is a majority in favour in the House of Commons for going on to WTO terms, that's what's going to happen. So I think it seems to me unlikely that the UK is going to go on to WTO terms in December 2020, because I think either the trade deal is done, or there's some agreement on continuity basis for continuing trade while the negotiations go on, or the transition is extended. But, you know, if MPs want to seek particular assurance on that, I don't think people in the ERG should freak out about that, because, you know, again, if there is a big Tory majority and the reasons for the trade talks failing are kind of, in inverted commas, EU intransigence, then you have to imagine that the government wanted to go onto WTO terms, you have to imagine that with a majority, the government would be able to do that. I think one of the things that we are all forgetting is that all these questions about the future are essentially questions about what will happen in a new parliament, and we don't know what the composition or balance of that parliament will be.
Mm-hmm. And Katie, the MPs are worried about this so-called trapdoor to a no-deal Brexit so much that they're thinking about putting it forward as one of the amendments in the committee stages today or tomorrow. Is that looking likely to pass?
Potentially. I mean, we have seen that there is a majority in this parliament against a no-deal Brexit. So it follows that I think there are MPs who will consider trying to do what they can to prevent a no-deal Brexit in a year's time, just as they did so to try and prevent it at the end of this month. I think there are still some MPs who think let's just get this Brexit deal done and sort these things out later. What Number 10 is very keen to emphasise, along with ministers, is the fact that, yes, not everything is decided in this, but ultimately what they're trying to do is give the House of Commons a say. Now, as James points out, ultimately, what the House of Commons says depends on what happens in the upcoming election, which we do expect to get, rather than potentially drag it out to 2022. If you drag it out to 2022, I think you probably get more indecision. But it follows that I don't think you can take no deal off the table, even if you pass this amendment, because ultimately, if there is a majority in the House of Commons, a Conservative majority of MPs who are willing to countenance that, they can ultimately do what they want as soon as there's a majority. And vice versa, if you have a Labour Lib Dem coalition government and they can work together to pass various things, I think it's probably quite likely that Brexit in some way is either softened significantly or you have a second referendum at some point. So there are concerns, and I think people are concerned with the pace of this timetable, but I do think there is a limit to what you can actually do in terms of getting rid of trapdoors or risks permanently. It just, I don't think, is durable. I think that if you look at, I suppose, the programme motion, which is a big vote today, that's the thing which we're not 100% sure the government has the numbers for. They are confident about the second reading. But how does it go with this timetable? Because I think people expected a speeded up timetable. I think when it broke last night and it was almost breakneck speed, get it out of the Commons by this Thursday, I think that was a bit faster than even some MPs who were coming round to the idea of doing things quickly were expecting. Speaking to various figures in the 21 Brexit rebels, so, you know, those Tory MPs who voted for the Benn legislation, who had the whip withdrawn, who seem to, broadly speaking, have decided not to go for a custom machining amendment later in the week if we get to it. I think there are some who are a little bit uneasy about the pace of this. So I don't think it is a given that they will all vote for the programme motion tonight. And I think another thing I've heard is some of them actually feel a little bit almost unloved in the sense that they haven't been getting calls from the Tory whips. They haven't been being chased about what they're going to do. And I think that perhaps if there's some TLC in the space of the day, they might start to come round. But, you know, one said to me that they haven't had someone say, are you backing with us on the programme motion? Now, they may decide to anyway, but I think there's a few things going on there. And also, clearly there is potentially a route back for some of these rebels if they vote in a certain way. But I don't think it has been laid out in crystal clear terms for them. I think perhaps that would be the carrot you would want rather than the stick.
And James, amongst the people who have been involved in the backlash to this programme motion and the speed of it are Ken Clark and Rory Stewart, two people whose whips were withdrawn earlier this year.
Well, it's interesting because they will vote for second reading of the bill. They will vote, both have said they will vote for the final deal. But this is why, as Katie said, this is why the programme motion is the crunch. In terms of October 31st, the programme motion is the crunch vote. So those are two votes for second reading and a vote for the deal at the end of this process. But it's not certain that which way they will both go on the programme motion, because the programme motion isn't just motorway driving. This is kind of German Autobahn, you know, no speed limits.
Give us an idea of the comparison. Like, how quickly do bills go through Parliament?
I think Maastricht was like 40 days of debate. I mean, I think the thing that lots of people are getting very excited about today is that I think the bill about wild animals and circuses had more time than this one. I think it is worth reflecting on what this one is doing. Though the function of this bill is purely to translate the deal into UK domestic law. If MPs set about changing it, there is a real risk that the EU simply says, well, that's non-ratification, because you are not putting the treaty into your domestic law. So, you know, to take a slightly absurd example, let's imagine that some Brexiteer said, I reckon the EU owes us money, so we're going to rewrite the $39 billion to say, actually, the EU owes us $15 billion. That, obviously, the EU at that point would say, well, that's non-ratification. And I think the point is, you know, some of the other examples are less dramatic, but lots of us. And also, I think, in terms of scrutiny, I think the government have a decent argument that because they are accepting this thing called the Nandy-Snell Amendments, which allows Parliament to vote on the mandate for the trade talks, those who have questions and worries about the future relationship actually do have a vehicle. MPs are going to get a vote on the future relationship and what they think about our customs union, what they think about this, what they think about that, what they think about services, all these things. So there is an opportunity for parliamentary scrutiny there. I think the other problem is, and this is why everyone has behaved badly during this process, right, which is the House of Lords would normally be entitled to say, whoa, slow down, we're the revising chamber here, you're going far too fast. The problem is, because the House of Lords speeded up its processes to get through the Cooper Bill and the Benn Bill, then they really don't have the moral high ground to say, slow down, because if they can pass those bills, which have huge implications for the balance of power in our constitution in a couple of days, why can't they do it for this treaty? And I think that is a problem, which is if you basically bend procedure to suit your own political needs, you can't complain that much when the same thing is done to you.
James, but do you think more scrutiny could be a good thing, given that it doesn't seem like everyone is across the details? Steve Barclay, the Brexit secretary, seemed to have made a bit of a boo-boo yesterday, something that Labour politicians and The Guardian and the like have picked up on today.
Yeah, I mean, this is this says something about which bit of government actually negotiated this treaty. Hint, it wasn't Dexie. But, this fact about Northern Ireland is if you are a unionist, it is a problematic fact. I think the consent mechanism does change a lot, because Northern Ireland will have the ability to end these arrangements if it doesn't like them. But the fact that Northern Irish businesses are sending stuff to Great Britain will need to fill in the form is obviously an uncomfortable fact.
And, I mean, the DUP have been quick to say, well, we've been promised unfettered access, and does that count as it if you have all this paperwork? And I think the slight complication is, ultimately, the government want to pitch what Northern Ireland has as almost being great for Northern Ireland, because you have access to two different markets, you have two customs territories. But the problem is, if it seems as though there is more paperwork involved, it is more difficult, that might put off some people in terms of, or businesses in terms of where they put their business.
I'm not sure what's happened on this. There's a kind of question about, essentially, various online delivery companies. I know it's when you try to send presents to family members, but like basically charge you extra or won't deliver to Scotland. And I think that there is a genuine risk that Northern Ireland, these forms basically for Northern Ireland, could lead to basically online shopping becoming much, much harder for people in Northern Ireland, in that GB-based entities saying, oh, I can't bother to fill in that form. I think there might well need to be some legal obligation on business. I think that, some legal obligation on businesses that they have to be able to, cover the entirety of the UK in their sales. I think that might be a necessary corrective to say to any business thinking, oh, I can't be bothered to fill in the forms to send stuff to, to shoppers in Belfast. I think that might well be necessary.
But to be fair to businesses, it also seems like it could be a bit pricey as well. There was an impact assessment that came out last night that said these forms could cost from £15 to £56.
Look, I think government imposes lots of obligations on businesses that cost them money. And, obviously, being on the centre-right one would prefer them to be relatively small and not too onerous. But I don't think an obligation to cover the whole of the UK is particularly unfair.
And Katie, today The Times is reporting on a Brexit Party candidate who stood down from the Brexit Party in order to vote for Boris Johnson's Brexit deal. Tell us more about that.
Yes, so this is one Brexit candidate gone, and the Brexit Party are very keen to point out that they have over 600 candidates, so this is not an important development and they're absolutely fine. I would say the complication there is, we have seen since Boris Johnson's Brexit deal was unveiled, various Brexit Party candidates, Brexit Party MEPs, say encouraging things about the deal on social media. I think it was Lucy Harris, one MP, on the day of the vote, there's a suggestion you hear from them, which is, let's see if this Remain Parliament stops this, or you can get Brexit free. Now, figures in the Brexit Party play this down as it's all about how you pitch yourself. It's not actually they're leaving the party. But I think because Boris Johnson's Brexit deal has, broadly speaking, landed well with the Leave vote, in the sense that he hasn't had a single cabinet resignation, the bulk of the ERG, if not all of them, plan to vote for it, there's a chance a handful abstain, there is the sense that this, it's much harder to say this is Brexit in name only. And I think you add to that the the initial polls, which showed that this is landing much better with Leave voters. And actually, there is almost, and you've got to take the polls, as of all polls, with a pinch of salt, but particularly because in the first polls we've had on this, you do have a big don't know, because lots of people don't know what the deal is. But if you take that away, there is, I think, more people supporting the deal than opposed to it. So I think it just does mean that it is harder for Nigel Farage and others, and they keep trying to do it, you know, Martin Daubney, to say that this is, you know, a betrayal of the result, look at this. And you get the sense that A, it's not landing as easily as clearly it did with Theresa May's deal, but two, not even the whole party is united in that position.
And James, it does look like Brexit Party supporters are coming on side as well. A recent poll said that 2/3 of Brexit Party supporters support Boris Johnson's deal as well. Is this the end of the Brexit Party, if he can get this through?
Well, I mean, if Brexit happens, the Brexit Party will lose its MEPs. I'm sure that there will always be an argument in British politics that the relationship with Europe should be even looser than whatever has been negotiated. In the same way, there'll be an argument that it should always be closer than what has been negotiated. But I do think motive matters in politics. And Theresa May's problem was that people looked at her and her chancellor, and they saw two kind of former Remainers who they thought were basically carrying out the instruction of the referendum because they had to, but trying to limit it as much as possible. When they look at Boris Johnson, they see the guy who delivered the Leave vote in 2016. And so, you know, as one cabinet minister said to me, kind of motive matters in politics. People assume that if there are compromises in this deal, it's because he's had to make compromises to get it through, not because he doesn't want Brexit to happen. I also think that a lot of the criticisms that you hear of the deal from Brexit Party spokespeople or advocates is essentially criticisms of the transition period. And I think the transition period is by definition, it is a standstill transition. It's not an unreasonable thing. You know, it took 40 odd years for the UK to get this far in. To take a bit more time to ensure that the departure is smooth, orderly and amicable doesn't strike me as unreasonable.
Katie and James, thanks very much. And you can subscribe to this podcast and all our other podcasts on the iTunes Store or wherever you get your podcasts from. Thanks for listening, and join us again tomorrow.